This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright. Sadiq and Sara Juma, who were Muslim Somali refugees living in Norway, received an email from their missing daughters, Layla and Ayan. It read, "We love you both so much." But the daughters weren't actually missing. Layla, who is 16, and Ayan, who was 19, had fled Norway and gone to Syria to join the Islamic State. At first, the family thought the sisters were kidnapped, but after some reflection, Sara and Sadiq realized their daughters had been radicalized. Sadiq went on a rescue mission to bring his daughters home, but to no avail. Özna Seierstad describes this family's tumultuous journey in her new book, Two Sisters, A Father, His Daughter, and Their Journey into the Syrian Jihad, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Özna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a harrowing tale. Let's start with, I guess, the beginning. Sadiq and Sara are, as I said, Muslim Somalis. They're residing in Norway with their five children. What brought the family to Norway in the first place?
Sadiq was a child soldier in the civil war in Somalia in the 90s. He was on the winning side, but what happens after a civil war is usually that the winners are starting to infight. And he decided this was no longer a war to die for, so he bought a passport, and in that passport there was a stamp with a visa to Norway. So he settled in Norway first on his own, and then after a couple of years he was able to bring his family over to finally get the family together in a peaceful place. He is integrating quite easily. The kids are integrating also quite easily. They are living a life more or less like the Norwegian kids, going to sports events, swimming, going to the beach as children. But there's one person in the family who doesn't integrate, and that is the mother.
And what and as I gather, she, part of her thing is she wanted to keep her daughters prevent them from getting too Norwegian.
When they were children, she didn't really care so much. She never learned Norwegian. She never studied Norwegian, never held a job. Her group of reference was her Somali girlfriends in Norway. So what happened when the girls became teenagers, that's when she started to fear that she was losing them to Norway. She saw them dressing in skinny jeans and t-shirts. She was afraid they would get boyfriends, starting to drink alcohol, going to parties. And then she did whatever she would have done in Somalia. When there's a problem in the family, you go to the local mosque and you ask the imam what to do with my girls. She did that, she and her girlfriends, and they got the answer that, you know, you should hire this Quran teacher. It was a brilliant, good-looking, young 19-year-old Somali man who had the great reputation of drawing kids into Islam. So they joined forces, put their money together, and hired him. And according to the father, Sadiq, that was the start of the nightmare.
And why was Sara reluctant to sort of integrate more into Norwegian society? Was that just about that's how she was comfortable, or was there an active opposition? Where was she coming from?
I think there's a lot of fear in it, and we do fear what we don't know. Sara is illiterate herself, so she's a very
illiterate in Norwegian,
in Somali, in all languages, and of course then it's more difficult to learn a language. And she brought up cooking and cleaning for her family, and she moves to Norway, and of course, yes, she is put in Norwegian classes because everyone gets, and they have to join 600 lessons of Norwegian training, but there's no demand that they actually need to learn something. They just need to sit in. And that's what she did, and then she never really bothered, actually. She was happy with her life was within the four walls of the house. The problem then arises when in Somali culture it's often the mother who raises the children, right, whereas the father is often absent. So it's like this woman who doesn't know what society her children live in, who can never help them with homework or read, you know, messages from teachers and so on, she's supposed to raise them. So when she sees that they're slipping away into Norway in that melting pot, as she t- told me she saw Norway as us, and she was afraid they would melt into the society and she wouldn't, you know, be able to get them back. And yeah. and when they hired this Quran teacher, it was like really successful to her view in the beginning, where they're discarded of their skinny jeans and t-shirts, and they started to veil and started to wear long dresses and started to read the Quran, and she was quite happy. And she was not able to read those other signs, those other worrying signs that followed.
What were some of the worrying signs? I gather that at one point they started adapting Muslim practices that weren't Somali, that the family didn't recognize as from their own Muslim tradition. Is that correct?
Yes. So first they just became more observant, which was good. You know, praying 5 times a day, dressing more properly, fasting, and just like behaving better, not going to parties, and threw away all the old clothes. Then it's when they were only 14 and 17, they came home with the full niqab, which is the full coverage. And nor Sara nor Sadiq liked that, because it's not part of Somali culture, it's Arab culture. Mm. And they also felt that this is very foreign in Norway. So they were not allowed to wear that. And then it was other things that made problems for the girls in school, because in this very strict Quran teaching, this was like, you know, the dividing of the sexes, that, you know, they couldn't have group work with a boy. They couldn't even, you know, use the pencil that a boy had held earlier. They had to wear gloves because maybe a boy had touched the handle of the door before them. So it's like they're becoming more and more extreme, but also in the way that made life quite difficult in a Norwegian, you know, high school.
Yeah. And that felt oppressive to Sadiq, at least, correct? He felt like these were sort of oppressive things that his daughters were going through.
Yeah, he's very liberal. He's a musician. He's a poet. He's the father is very much adapting to Norwegian culture. Never really very successful in Norway, mostly living on welfare, but he was part of the Norwegian society, I would say. But again, he was very distant. So it was very much left to this mother to follow what they were doing. But everyone failed reading the signs, also the school. The school saw they were coming in this full niqab coverage and so on, and becoming more extreme, supporting the 9/11 terror and so on. But the teachers thought this was the work of the parents. Yep. And they tried to talk to the parents, whereas nobody had the fantasy or the imagination to think that this is the girls, they're drivers of their own fate here. And also, interestingly, you saw how integrated these two girls were. Like, when they were protesting, they were saying that this was because they were feminists. Like, it was their feminist right to wear, to cover up. Like, because in the West, women are forced to undress. That's their feminist right to cover up. So it's like they were really very much using the tools of a Western democracy, of what they'd learn in school, in the society, to protest against those rights that they actually had achieved.
I'm speaking with Norwegian author and journalist Åsne Seierstad about her new book, Two Sisters, A Father, His Daughter, His Daughters, and Their Journey into the Syrian Jihad. So they depart at some point. How does the family learn of their departure?
They just don't come home after school is finished. And they start to wonder, and they start calling them, and there's no answer. And then there's an email saying that we've gone to Syria. Don't be mad. Don't be sad. We're never coming back. But this is the right path for us as Muslim, and we're going to save you all. So first, the parents think that they don't get it. Is it a joke? Is it someone else wrote it? But then they actually get in contact with the girls the same evening, and they realize this is happening. And then what Sadiq does, and that there comes his background in the fact that he was a child soldier, he could carry a weapon. He follows them into the war zone. So only he has like 3 days delay after them, and he actually finds them after a few weeks in Syria.
Within 3 days, he just immediately springs into action.
He leaves 3 days on the same plane, not even knowing exactly where they went. He's able to find them. So he's very clever, smart, but also including in the war zone. And the fact that you can't just just go as a father into Syria and look for your girls. You'll be very quickly arrested as a spy, as other fathers have been. He joins up with al-Nusra, which was the al-Qaeda branch of the Syrian al-Qaeda branch. And they are the good guys in this story. They're actually trying to help him against ISIS. So it's also a book where I'm trying to explain the scene in Syria, the different militant groups.
Which is more complicated than we understand from afar.
I have tried to simplify it, but it's just actually to show how messy it was and who were fighting and changing groups. But he is then able to track them down, and he meets the older sister, the younger sister at the point is then injured by a bullet. So he can't find her. But he meets the older sister, and she tells him that when he comes and said, finally, Ayan and Leila, you're coming back with me and back to mommy. And they say, well, we can't remarry now. This is where we live. This is where we want to live.
And they say they've done all of this out of love for their parents too, right?
Yeah, because if you die as a martyr, which you are very likely to do in Syria, you can bring 72 members of your family to paradise. Mm. So this radicalization is very religious. Of course, it's about identity, it's about many things, but it's also the fact that they really believe that what is happening here and now, it's not real life. Right. Real life is what happens after death. What we experience here is just a test, and the better we score on the test here in this life, the better place in paradise. And if you then die as a martyr, you can bring your whole family free of charge, right entry into paradise. And that's the eternal joy in paradise. So it's like, it was interesting to see how these very ordinary teenage girls change step by step into very religious fundamentalist girls.
What was the text that Ayan told her father that he should read in entirety?
That's a very interesting book by Abdullah Assam, who is kind of called the father of jihadism, the intellectual the explanation against jihadism, in the way that it allows children, girls, wives to wage jihad without the approval of the guardian, the father, the husband, and so on. So they use this book. He wrote that in the 80s. He was a friend of Osama bin Laden. He wrote this book in Afghanistan, and it's kind of a manual for the young jihadists today, that they are allowed to do it, because in ISIS, they also need to have justifications, even religious justifications for everything they do. And they use and abuse this book in order to say that, you know, young girls, we have the right to go without, you know, the parents' consent. And
where are the girls today? Did they stay, or have they come back?
They never come back. And as of now, we're not really sure. The parents don't really know. Last time we heard about them from them was in November. And then they had fled Raqqa, where they'd stayed for several years with their kids and husbands. And they fled to, well, further east in the desert. And now, today, there's only a little strip of land between Syria and Iraq, which is still held by ISIS, and a few other pockets. So they might be there. They might be dead. There's been a lot of bombing in that area. Yeah. Nobody knows where they are.
Quickly, we only have about a minute, but this is not your first book on extremist ideologies. You have written previously, One of Us was the title of the book, about a neo-Nazi who killed Muslims. What's the through line? What is the through line on radicalization, very quickly?
Oh, yes, there's definitely a growing trend on each side, and I think they also feed on each other. The way that they both think that if we just cleanse, if we just get away of the Muslims, or if we just get away, you know, the Shia Muslims, or that they kind of, they have these simple ideas of purification of us and them. Mm-hmm. We stand above them. And, of course, for Breivik, his targets and main opposers would be extremist Muslims like these girls. And for them, when they talk about, you know, Norwegians and how we look at them, they use him as an example. So it's very dangerous that these two radical extremist trends growing in Europe today and in America they need each other.
I've been speaking with Norwegian journalist and author Åsne Seierstad about her about her book, Two Sisters, a Father, His Daughters, and Their Journey into Syrian Jihad. Tonight at 6:30, she will be speaking at NYU's Carter Journalism Institute. That's at 20 Cooper Square. Thanks so much for joining me today for this conversation.
Thank you.